You've tuned in to part two of a workshop on passive house construction given by Guido Wimmers, the architect from Austria, now located in British Columbia, Canada.
And what about wood and fire? Did you have any problems here in BC with regards to code and regulations as concerns that the amount of wood used, the nature of wood, where it was used in fire code?
So in terms of the windows directly, no. It just becomes an issue if you're, for example, the next neighbor's very close and you have to have a fire-resistant window.
Fire ingress.
Then it becomes a problem because you cannot use wood frames anymore. In some of these situations, you get some problems. For this building in general, because it's totally just a little bit of concrete, but basically everything else, the structural systems, is based on wood. We have to build in sprinklers, because it's kind of an assembly building. Also after the games, it will be used by the mountain bike club and by the cross country skiing club, and they will use it as an assembly building, so we have to put in some sprinklers. But that's not necessarily, that's not related to passive house or not so solid wood, because if you would go with other wood materials, you would have the same problem.
Heat loss, how do you deal with heat loss with such big windows? You said it compensates the amount of sun that comes in, but what about in wintertime?
When I talk about heat loss and compensate, I'm just referring to the heating period. So, in summertime, I just try to get as less sun into the building as possible just to get rid of overheating. That's another issue. During the wintertime, I want to expose quite a bit of windows to the south, to the sun, to harvest, so to say, the energy and just let it in. The coatings on the glass are pretty specific, and that's the biggest obstacle I've found so far with buying the glass here. North American glass industry is perfect in very low shading coefficient or solar heat gain coefficient, just to keep the sun out. Makes sense if you take a look to the city with the high rises and everything, where pretty much the whole envelope is made out of glass. If you would have a high coefficient, then you would just let too much energy into and you would run into incredible troubles with overheating. The European industry, glass industry, is focusing on a total different thing. They always try to keep that level as high as possible, have a very good U value, but still let a lot of sunlight into. Because even commercial buildings, and I mean, Europe don't have that many high rises, so not so many glass towers, and even the towers we the Europeans have less glass content in the facade than we see here. So the industry are just focusing on different parts. What we want to have is very good U value. So that means we just lose a small amount of energy during wintertime, during nighttime, and so on. But a very high solar heat gain coefficient to harvest a lot of energy. And this kind of combination is tricky to find.
So that's why those windows are hard to get. Because normally you lose, if you've got a lot of glass in a building, you'll lose it all.
So I think you can find this glass, but you really have to discuss with, and I'm doing that currently because we're setting up a window manufacturing plant to produce these windows here. So it is possible, but it's really kind of work to find these kind of combinations and companies who are actually willing to go that way, because that's not the typical way. Most glass producers are focused on the mass market, and that's understandable, sure. I mean, that's how they make money. So just a few of them are willing to explore new ideas, so to say. But that was just the glass. The frame is the biggest problem because there's nobody producing these insulated frames. And the frame is still, even with these high-performance windows, the frame is still the weakest part. U-value of the frame is roughly 0.8, something like that. The one of the wall is 0.1, which means we lose 8 times more energy through the frame than through the wall, if you compare it just by the area. So that makes clear that the frames are in total the weakest part. So yeah, later we came up with a different solution, so that gave us the possibility to even to reach a little bit under the overhang, but then you can see we had to find other solutions. We built a ramp, we had these little round wooden sticks, and then, like the old Egypts, we just rolled.
You harvested all the energy.
Pardon me?
You harvested all the energy with
Well, it was just, yeah.
Yeah, these machines work just with a sandwich or something like that. Yeah. It's not that bad.
How do you retain the sun's energy inside the building? Do you not get a sort of greenhouse effect where you've got a massive amount of retained heat just the other side?
In the summertime, no, because you have the overhang.
Even in the winter?
In the wintertime, because it's directly there, it's the biggest thermal mass, so the concrete. So most of these southern windows have the thermal mass of the concrete, which slows down the process extremely. And even the upper part, there the windows are slightly less, it's not that much. But still, there are quite a few windows, they have the solid wood layer. And on top of the solid wood is still 5 centimeter concrete layer, concrete topping.
The concrete slab is the other side of the window.
Yeah, so in total, you always have that kind of buffering system with the thermal mass. And so we have calculated and simulated the whole thing, and it looks like that's actually working very well. So it shouldn't be a problem at all in wintertime. If, I don't know exactly, but I think we assume that about 20 people are in the building. If there are to be 50, 60 or more are in the building, then slowly the temperature will rise, which in the first case leads into just shutting down the heating system completely. And if that's not enough, yeah, okay, maybe you have to open the window. But because for heating purposes, that building used less than 10% of a Canadian average building, even if you open the window and let escape some heat, it's actually not that bad. You know, because you're in another dimension still.
It did get uncomfortable the other side of the window.
Well, these are maybe just really peak loads and kind of extreme situations. So for 95% of over the year, it shouldn't be a problem at all. The next critical thing was to, I mentioned already heat bridges, but when you build with wood, generally you don't have these huge troubles with heat bridges. You have them with concrete because concrete has relatively high heat conductivity. Heat bridge means you have a penetration from the inside to the outside, and you transfer heat from the inside to the outside, or in summertime, vice versa. You transfer heat from the outside to the inside, which leads into overheating. So heat bridges is one issue, but it was actually not that tricky here for that building. The airtightness, that's actually the bigger thing you have to take care of. So the way how to install the windows, the way how to connect all the joints of your envelope. And here, for example, that shows how the windows are seals to the floor. So first you have a primer, and then you go with a special type of tape. These tapes, well, the critics say, okay, we don't know actually how long they last. And that's true, we don't know. The only thing what I do know is, because I did some research work back in Austria, that they last at least at 100% for 10 years. Okay, 10 years is maybe not that long. But because we know that there was no weakness at all for 10 years, we assume that they actually last for way longer. The glue technology is, I mean, all the people who fly with Air Canada, most of the planes of Air Canada are Airbus, and 95% of all connections in an Airbus are glued. They're not screwed, they're not welded, or whatever, they're glued. So actually we trust that industry quite well. I think these kind of tapes should last for a long, long time, but it's true, we don't know exactly for how long.
You mentioned the heat time difference between the window frame and the wall.
Yeah,
and
up to.
On an equal amount of heat. Is there no such thing in theory of a frameless window?
Well, for a fixed window, theoretically, yes, you could do that.
Or it could go right into the wall structure with glue and have no frame?
Yeah.
Can you move from glass
that
to
is,
wall?
Right. That is theoretically possible, but you run into some problems because every wood building moves over time. So from summer to winter, in terms of humidity, in terms of different temperatures, you have some movement in that window. So you have to give the glass quite a bit of room to move. So the usual solution is, you have something like a chair, which where you can rely on that you have that gap of at least 5-6 millimeter, where the glass in the frame can move.
Just another problem to be solved over time.
Right. For all openable parts, it's a little bit more tricky. But as I said, so we are currently working on setting up something here, and the idea is, at least from the outside, you just have glass. Technically, there's still something like a wooden wing from behind, because you need something to screw in your hardware and all that stuff. You can theoretically could screw it into the glass, but nobody would pay for it. I mean, that's just too expensive. So theoretically, yeah, you're right. You could do something like that. I think realistically, we're not, so simply not there yet. Maybe we'll see something like that over the next 10, 20 years.
Is the main problem with the frame conductivity? There are a few very high-tech insulations like aerogel.
Yeah, exactly, and that's exactly what we're looking at.
You're going to use it.
Because aerogel has roughly double the insulation value of styrofoam, for example.
Did you talk to NASA first?
No, we don't. No. Well, there are quite a few exotic things out there. Also, vacuum isolated products, I think, simply too expensive. But for exotic solutions, whatever, there are quite a few things out there. But the aerogel, I think this is the most promising, so to say, because it's relatively cheap to manufacture, to produce it, and has extremely good values. I don't like foams in general. I don't want to work with foams if I don't have to. But that's another issue. So airtightness was a very big issue. You have to seal all the joints and all the gaps, and I think that these photos show that this is not the final solution. Again, this is a call to the industry. We have to find better solutions. This is how we achieve airtightness these days. Yeah, that's probably the best way we can do it now. But I don't want to say, hopefully we will have better solutions in 5 or 10 years. The materials themselves, they are quite flexible in terms of that they can move. So for the joints between a concrete slab and the wooden parts, you need something like a butyl tape or something like that. They can expand 10 times their actual size, so they are very flexible. But that's how you, these days, how you achieve the airtightness. And the airtightness is always from the inside, so it has to be on the inside layer. The next thing what we did was a blower door test, and some people here know him. Yeah, Troy Glasner, the guy with the machine, was kind of a funny story because he was just simply not believing what he was seeing on his display. It goes even so far that he was calling the company who produced the door block unit, but finally we came up. So the real value was 0.26 for pressurization and 0.3 for depressurization. The not so good part is that these numbers are actually there's quite a bit of difference in between, which indicates that there are some failures and some materials work like a valve. So you have overpressure and the overpressure just seals it, and then you depressurize and it opens. So if you have such a big difference in between, it shows you there are some issues somewhere in the building. But on the other side, I don't know who is familiar with the R2000 program, the a little bit older Canadian version of airtightness, which was just measured in one direction, not in both. I think that's a significant, you have to do it in both. Otherwise you don't figure out where your root problems are. But the value was 1.5, so that was assumed to be an airtight building. For a passive house, you have to be below 0.6. That's a requirement. You have to be below 0.6. And we achieved that very well. So 0.3 or an average 0.28 is quite a good thing. So quite a good building. It is the unofficial record, at least of BC. That's what we heard. So, but simply the reason to achieve airtightness, well, there are several reasons, but one thing is, if you don't achieve airtightness, then through your gaps and joints, warm air will escape. So you lose energy. Okay. You could argue, okay, that little bit of energy I can pay, so this is not a big deal. The big deal is that if you don't have airtightness, warm air is going through your envelope, which means humidity is transported with it. And if so, you, in that envelope, you will, somewhere, you will reach the dew point, so you will have condensation. And it's always the same. So water is not a problem, or the other way around. Vapor is not a problem. So as long as water is vapor, it's not a problem. When it becomes liquid, then it's a problem. And airtightness is just to prevent this kind of condensation and some liquid water in your envelope. I was not that familiar with it, but maybe the professionals know what it means. So the equivalent air leakage area, it's, what is that, at 50 and 10 Pascal in square foot. So whoever is professional and knows about that. So the area is relatively small. It's a tenth of, what do you call it, a tenth of a square foot. It's a relatively small area. So yeah, then they went on with the sheeting material and everything, just a few photos. And that's more or less how it looks like today. This was still during the building period, but almost done. From the inside, also the furniture was sponsored by some Tyrolean companies, so wooden design furniture. That was during the games, and it's still up to today like that, so for some smaller receptions and stuff like that. So these are just some impressions. On Monday, so 2 days from now, on Monday will be the official transfer from the Austrians to the municipality of Worcester. Monday, Tuesday, we will have a small conference there. After that, the building will be more or less closed for, I don't know, exactly 2-4 weeks, something like that, to do some adjustments and just to adapt the building to the next user. During that time, it would not be a problem at all to visit it, because there were always workers, and if you say, well, can I just peek in, and they will say, yeah, sure, take a look. But after that, the two clubs will take over, and I'm pretty sure everybody will have access to them. Yeah, that was the building during the game. So you see with all the lighting stuff and so on. And the upper part was the television crew or the Austrian broadcaster. And now I just want to show a few other things what happened in between. So just went back. So this, any specific question about this one before we just go to a few other examples? And then
your walls are solid. Where are you putting your surface?
But generally, what you do is.
You have internal walls that aren't solid?
Yeah. First of all, this. So quite a few of the electrical stuff and so on is in the simple kind of separation walls, just stop walls.
How do you get over the building code that requires electrical outlet every?
We didn't. We have the plus every, what is that, 10 feet or whatever?
12 feet.
Or 12 feet, yeah. So that was not possible, so we had to do that. What you do is you drill a hole through the 10 centimeter of solid wood, and so from the inside you just have your ordinary plug there. You seal it on the outside.
Conduit?
So, yeah. You seal it on the outside, and then you pack your insulation on it, and then your venting area, and then the facade.
So it's between the wood and the insulation. Exterior.
Right. It is in the layer of the insulation.
Yeah.
But you have to seal that part because that's the layer of the real air tightness in vapor retarder.
Yeah.
A barrier means you seal it. Yeah. Actually,
I just want to slow it down.
Yeah. So I would love to call it vapor retarder. Disadvantage, but yeah, it's good that you mentioned that, because the disadvantage is to change all that stuff later on. If you want to have another plaque or another something somewhere, that's actually not easy.
You got to keep signing them.
Yeah.
That's no different than an insulator.
So you always have these, how do you call these, the empty ducts where you can just put the cable inside?
Conduit.
Okay. So you can change the cable, or you can add another cable, but you cannot change the orientation.
The location.
That becomes the other tricky.
To answer the question which you sort of alluded to earlier as to the cost, could you give an estimate, if you have one, of the per square foot construction cost of a building like that as compared to, let's say, a comparable building built in Whistler with standard technique?
Okay, this building is quite exotic in several different ways because it was shipped, everything was imported. I mean, nobody wants to do that. If you build a building in Whistler, you don't want to import everything. It was solid wood. It's not necessary to build with solid wood. So there were quite a few of exotic features. Then we had to deal with two totally different user groups. So during the games and after the games, that made it more expensive. Again, I would estimate that, percentage-wise, it's tricky because if you build something in, I don't know, South Surrey, you can build for less than 180 bucks per square foot.
130 right now.
130. That's scary.
It was down to 70 a year ago.
Only lasts for 2 years. if you build something in Whistler, I don't know, you're probably at 300 bucks or more. I mean, I know quite a few companies there, and for them, it becomes interesting if the owner is willing to pay at least $150 per square meter. Otherwise, they don't start. So because of that huge difference, it doesn't make sense to say anything in percentage. I think from my experience here, and I want to show you a few other buildings which are unfortunately not passive house, but were clearly going into that direction. From this experience, I would estimate 250 per square foot seems to be like the lower borderline. So yeah, it should be doable to 40, 250, something like that per square foot. Certainly comfortable, I would say 300, yeah, no problem at all. But I would estimate 250, 260 should be doable. And yeah, it's maybe a little bit more expensive than average, yeah, no question, but you get way more.
The value to the consumer of the person living in the house, using the house or building, over what period of time could you recover that cost in terms of energy saved?
If you tell me the energy cost here in BC next year, in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, we can theoretically calculate. But first of all, you have that kind of unknown. Then here in BC, we have to, well, we struggle with ridiculous low energy costs. It's almost that we don't pay. We don't pay for water and for electricity, and we just pay a little bit. It's 6 point something cents. So selling energy saving technologies over payback period simply doesn't work, because not here in BC. It would work in Washington, for example, where they pay roughly 3 times as much or 2.5 times as much. There it becomes more interesting. So just because you save energy and then with a payback period, no, you will never sell these type of buildings. Like you will never sell a Lexus, a Mercedes, or a BMW because of its payback period or fuel efficiency. Nobody's asking that. You're buying these because of a total different motivation. Yeah, you want to have high quality, maybe even status symbol, but it's about well-being, essentially. That's what it is. And these buildings, they deliver healthy climate, so it's about health. Thermal comfort, so it's just kind of a luxury living. And yes, it's at the end, it comes down to well-being. So if people are interested in that, then yeah, they have to in some way maybe to afford it. But I don't want to say that a lot of social housing projects are done with that, because in Europe, energy prices are way higher. So if we reach that level over the next 5 to 10 years, then it's totally different game. Right now, it's more for the first, you know, the people who just want to go for it with some green conscience or whatever.
Can I just ask you a quick question about thermal mass? And did you use wooden floors and radiant heat? Did you use that at all?
You could use radiant heat, and generally, I would always prefer to have some smaller radiant heat system instead of just totally relying on forced air or whatever. The point is that you don't need your whole slab with radiant heat, because the amount of energy you have to put in your building is so small that you can actually work with maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 square meter in the bathroom and a few square meters somewhere else, and that's actually enough. So I totally agree. Yeah, radiant heat is a very nice one. That's what is more comfortable for us humans instead of forced air system.
But did you use did you use wood floors or cement floors?
Cement floors.
Okay.
Well, the sprinkler system still visible in the
front. Yeah. You can see something here. So not nice. And that was kind of, that problem was not addressed for a very long time. Nobody had really thought about that. And the municipality came up with that almost at the last minute call. So we haven't had any choice just to do it the way it is. So it's visible from the inside. It was by far the cheapest way. If we had known about that up front, we would have integrated it in some way. But that's the way it is.
Are you ventilating the house, getting rid of the moisture, getting the air exchange?
Yes. Yes, I have not addressed the mechanical system, and at least partially on purpose, because passive housing, the idea is to reduce the system in general. But still, you need something
to change the air.
Yeah. So what you need is a ventilation unit with heat recovery. And the heat recovery has to have a very good efficiency, minimum 80%, better 85-90%. It's just a very, very few, but there are some companies in North America, so you could buy them, these units. And then it's about how to heat. And there are, generally, there are different systems. So one thing is that you produce some warm water and put it into a radiant heating system somewhere. Costs a little bit more because you need the heat pump and the water-based system and then put in the slab heating somewhere. But is in terms of comfort, thermal comfort is probably the best thing you could do. The other version is that you have a heat pump and that one uses directly the ventilation air. So again, you have forced air, but please, it's not comparable with what you commonly know under forced air because temperature is way lower, has to be under 50 degrees at the heat exchanger. I don't know how many it is with a classic system. I mean, 180 degrees, okay. It has to be lower than 50 because at 52 there begins a thermal pyrolysis of dust, which actually can produce pretty toxic fumes.
50 Celsius?
52, 53 Celsius is okay, like where that process starts. Yeah, it's always Celsius. It has to be below 50 degrees Celsius. And you have some limits in terms of ventilation rates. So you don't want to go over 0.5 air changes per hour, for example, because then you have the risk, especially in winter, that your air just gets too dry because you don't produce that much humidity inside. You get cold air from the outside, heat it up, which means the relatively humidity drops down significantly. And if it drops down under certain values, you get into troubles with, red eyes or eye irritation or respiratory system irritation. So you're fairly limited to that. So you need a very high efficient envelope to go with that small energy loads. And then theoretically you can use this, forced air system, but it's absolutely not comparable to the classic forced air system.
Sounds like the whole system is a lot of tricky interdependencies on air tightness, the materials.
It is a little bit more tricky to design it. You need an integrated design process. You need architects who actually know what they're doing. You need mechanical engineers who have kind of a motivation to minimize their system instead of maximizing it. So you need a good team to do that. And that costs, the major costs, additional costs are actually in the design process. It's less about the materials. It's more about the design process. But if that is done, the building more or less works on its own. So you don't have to do much more. In a conventional house, you have to behave more actively in terms of opening the window, going up with the heat, going down with the heater,
You're automating the house operations.
Yeah, you don't have to care about that anymore.
Yeah. Did you use any solar water collectors to supplement the heat for the hydron?
You could. But with a solar hot water, we are already in an energy generating system. That's the basic idea of the passive house is reduce the energy load. It's not about generating, it's reducing, saving energy, and increasing thermal comfort and all that, healthy living. But it's not about energy generation. When I start to produce energy in terms of a solar, just transform the heat, but make it usable for you in terms of warm water, that's the process of energy generating. You could add it. In fact, I've had some discussions with CMHC, and CMHC finally completely agrees that, CMHC said, agrees that passive house is the precondition for net zero, because you build a passive house, put some generating system on top, could be PV on top of the roof or whatever, and you have a net zero system or a net zero house. So it is the step up front. I think it's the one which really makes sense because we reduce your energy load by 90% and have additional cost of, okay, be careful, like 5 to 10% more. If you go for net zero, you just take care of the last 10%, but you have to pay at least another 10% on top. So in terms of efficiency, it makes sense. Reduce the energy load, save energy, and pay a little bit more, invest a little bit more into that. And just financially, these days, it doesn't make sense to go for energy generating systems.
Sounds to me like the whole idea here of passive house is a mindset change for the whole industry.
You
have different objectives to start.
Yeah, in some way, maybe it is, yeah. Just to finish, thoughts. Some other projects we have done so far, which are unfortunately not quite there yet, so it's not a passive house, but This building, for example, is simply not compact enough to achieve passive house because you have a lot of play in your envelope, you know. Theoretically, the best thing would be a sphere. Minimize your envelope, maximize your volume. Theoretically, okay, we know all that, that doesn't work. Well, science works. realistically, it has to be more, it don't have to be a box. But if you start like that with a lot of setbacks and stuff like that, you just run into troubles with heat bridges and with the compactness. But anyway, it's a pretty cool project. So, and achieved quite very well values. So was not quite passive house, but good, very good. Another one in Duncan, which was way more compact, but unfortunately couldn't achieve passive house criteria because it was on a slope and the slope was north oriented. So, and behind the house were huge trees. So simply no solar harvest in wintertime. In terms of envelope quality, it is a passive house. But in terms of overall performance, it cannot be because it cannot harvest enough solar energy in the winter. So what I try to say here is, even if you don't achieve passive house requirements in total, it still made sense to implement passive house technology because you still have the benefits of increased energy decreased energy bills and increased thermal comfort inside. That was another exotic project in a so-called heritage area. So officially it's a renovation. I think at the end, four beams and two posts were left from the original. But officially it was a renovation, so that's how it works, obviously. They have had a heat consumption of 26 kilowatt hours per square meter at the end. 15 was passive house. So it is already very close. But we couldn't reach it because we were not allowed to change the facade on the south. As you can tell here, in the south you have less windows than in the north. So this way it simply does not work. Another nice project, also not quite there. And here was the obstacle that the project itself, because it's a laneway house, is extremely small. So it's a very, very compact and small building. Compact is good, but it was just too small to achieve passive house values. But still, very, very good.
Is that the one on Commercial and First?
No, it's East Georgia, 600 something East Georgia.
What would the lower limit of size be to get a passive house? Could you do it 600 square feet? Do you have to have 1,000 square feet? Or?
I would estimate roughly, slightly over 1,000. So, let's say something like, for example, 1,200, decent size for a four-person household, something like that. Shouldn't be a problem at all. But the smaller you get, the more envelope you have for a relatively small area. And the energy is calculated down to the usable area. So that's what it is.
What was the square footage of Austria's house?
300, pretty much exact, 300. Yeah. 300 square meters, so 3,300 square meters. We've had quite a bit of exposure with the idea of passive house in between, so I'm now here since two and a half years already. It was really fun to work for passive house to push the idea. And these are just a few things. So we've had articles in several different magazines, courses for students, radio, TV, and quite a few different conventions. So for me, it was just great to see that quite a bit is going on. We founded just a few weeks ago the Canadian Passive House Coalition, which is kind of an association for advocacy and so on, just to push passive house.
Is there no government incentives yet? You're not anywhere near there yet to encourage or incentivize?
Quite frankly, no, we are not.
How about in Europe?
We have, oh yeah. Yeah.
Quite much further ahead.
In terms of incentives and so on, yeah.
Because of energy.
At the end, I think it's a very simple thing. It is in our own interest. It's in the interest of the society that more of these buildings get built. Mm-hmm. So it would be in the interest of a government to push that. And there are two different ways. One thing is, with a code, force the people to do so. And the other thing is to make it more attractive in terms of giving them some money or whatever. So just make it more attractive. The code version, so we have discussed quite a bit. The ideal goal would be to push for passive house criteria in the code by 2020. So we have had quite a few discussions and talks with that, with the Ministry of Energy, Mines and Petroleum Resources and so on. I'm not sure if we can reach that because these are the same goals like a lot of European countries have. But hey, they're working on passive house already since 20 years. So yeah, they are a little bit ahead. And in quite a few municipalities or provinces, it's mandatory. If you want to build something new for the municipality, it has to be a passive house. If you want to get some grants from the government for your building, it has to be passive house. Otherwise, you don't get anything. But that's quite a way to go. But I think it's important. And just if you come back to the first numbers, what we have seen, yeah, I've heard it quite often, Vancouver is so green. In fact, no. We are not there yet. And just let's face it, because the longer we just think, oh, we're doing good, we're just going on with baby steps, you know, with little tiny steps. So what we have to do is making large leap.
Though I think the wood is beautiful and everything, but wouldn't straw bale be more sustainable and cheaper to bring a passive house? Does that not?
More sustainable, maybe, but I'm just not sure if it's cheaper because the thickness of the wall becomes very, your overall system becomes, I'm not sure, maybe it would, but I don't have any experience with problem, so.
It costs more money to produce it than it does, than you can sell it. I know a guy who owns plants in
it's very, very labor intensive, and that's what I thought.
Seems to me that one of the partners that it would be wise for a passive house technologist or proponents like yourself in Canada would be to get the wood industry on your side. Purporting that you're going to sell more wood.
Yeah. And I've had the chance to promote passive house quite a few times with BC Wood, not BC Wood, what's called, we've had it here. So Wood Solution Fair, which is a relatively large conference. So there were 500 people in the room who were interested. So that was nice. But I totally agree. The wood industry is
a key player.
For them, it's kind of a natural fit.
But then you've also got to change their practices.
Well, that's right.
But some other things happen in between, and this is the most promising, I think, and we discussed already about it. So this is the passive design toolkit for homes. So it's published by the City of Vancouver. It's right now in the process of, it was done with you guys, so with Lighthouse Sustainable Center, and we teamed up to write that. And what I've heard is now it will be published in Seattle as well. So that's just good to see that right now it's just the toolkit. It's not mandatory, whatever. It's not a bylaw. It's just the toolkit. But I think it's an important first step into that direction.
Is the passive homes in the States or Washington any further ahead or similar to Canada?
I think they have 9 or 10 now. So yeah, a few more than Canada,
but in the same ball.
Yes.
So this toolkit is like to incorporate elements of the design of the passive house, right?
It gives you, I think it's pretty large, 70 pages, something like that. It gives you a wide or better understanding about the basic ideas of passive house and how to achieve that. It lists all the requirements. And that's what it is. So the idea was to inform, first of all, building authorities, the building inspector, and you know all these people in the process, because it's always painful if clients come and just want to apply for something, but there is a concrete wall because nobody knows what you are actually talking about. So first we have to educate building inspectors and everybody who is in that process. And then the professionals, the builders, and theoretically the last one is the client because it doesn't make sense if he wants to have it but nobody knows how it works. So here you have a good explanation about passive housing and what it actually means.
So what are the components then of the approach to designing a passive house? I mean, it's obviously multifaceted, all kinds of different things go into building a passive house.
Yeah.
What are the components that provide the greatest, you know, cost benefit, the greatest benefit per what you're putting into it, that one could incorporate into it to generally improve the process without going all the way to getting to that?
High performance envelope. Very, very simple. It is about the envelope. So it's about increasing the performance of your walls, of your roof, and of the windows. Just to break it down, that's very simple.
So
that's,
you could further simplify that to say insulation.
Yes.
Is this toolkit available on the internet?
Yeah, it's on the city's homepage. Unfortunately, I don't have the link in my head, but it's just on, so City of Vancouver, and then you just, if you Google Passive Design Toolkit Vancouver, you will find it. So it's a link as a PDF there. So you can download. There are actually two. One for larger and for commercial buildings. And this one, it's focusing more on small residential. In the future, we will have some exposure. So the Green Building Council, Canadian Green Building Council, will have his annual summit in Vancouver this year. It's always, last year was Toronto, this year is Vancouver. So we will have a chance to hear something there about Passive House. Buildex, we'll talk there as well. So it's not about promoting me, it's about promoting Passive House. If you hear or if you know people who want to hear more about it, just give them the information. And last thing, I just want to quote a German fellow, Max Planck. It's kind of sad, but I think it was right. So at the end, I think we cannot try to convince our opponents. That costs too much time, it's too much hassle, it's too much work. It's just not worth it. I think the simple thing, what we have to do is forget about that and just do it. Go on and do it. And so, not drink responsible, please build responsible.
Do I have to wait for the building inspector to die?
Any final questions?
Can you get a copy of that presentation at all?
Sure. I can give it to you guys as a PDF, and then you just put it on the homepage, is that okay?
Sure, yeah.
It will be on that homepage very soon, too. I will start that homepage next week somewhere. I don't know exactly when. So right now it's not online, but it will be online very soon.
And in about 3 weeks' time, at ecoshock.org, there will be a copy of this speech.
Right. Thank you.
That you can download as an MP3.